This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's so good to have you with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Those of you listening on radio, remember you can also hear us commercial-free online webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. An exciting show today. We've got Corey Hinderstein with us. She is Vice President, International Programs, of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Corey Hinderstein leads the Nuclear Threat Initiative's efforts related to the framework for global nuclear nonproliferation and security, improving nuclear security and other risk reduction efforts. And she is just absolutely riveting. You're going to enjoy every single minute of it. And we're going to have a visit to the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's get on to our guest. All right, today we're going to imagine a world without nuclear weapons. Woo! Isn't that a great thing to imagine? Of course, those of you who have been following developments in The Hague, President Obama was at the a nuclear summit to prevent nuclear terrorism. And today we have with us, we're real lucky to have Corey Hinderstein. She is the Vice President, International Programs for the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And she's just back from The Hague. And welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, let's explain a little bit about what the Nuclear Threat Initiative is. I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I'd like to make our audience familiar with it right from you. And then a rundown on how things went in The Hague.
Sure. The Nuclear Threat Initiative is a private foundation. We're based in Washington, D.C. And we were founded in 2001 by our co-chairs, Ted Turner and former Senator Sam Nunn. And the organization was founded with kind of a unique perspective, which was to think about how a non-governmental organization could actually make a difference on this issue of preventing nuclear terrorism. And for us, when we think about preventing nuclear terrorism, we think about securing, removing, or eliminating the nuclear material that's all over the globe that could be used in a terrorist nuclear weapon. In addition to the nuclear mission, we also do quite a lot of work on the issues of preventing nuclear, chemical, and biological terrorism.
Okay, so did I understand that Dick Lugar had something to do with this organization too, or is that another one I got confused with?
No, Senator Lugar is on our board of directors and has been a really instrumental member of that board since our founding. Many people might be aware that Senators Nunn and Lugar worked very closely together when they were both in the Senate, working in particular on securing and eliminating nuclear material and weapons from the former Soviet Union after the Soviet Union collapsed. And Senator Nunn brought a lot of that mission area, a lot of his interest in those issues to NTI. And Senator Lugar, although he stayed in the Senate longer until he left the Senate just recently, has remained a partner for Senator Nunn, but now from NTI's perspective, from the non-governmental side.
Kind of curious how Ted Turner got involved with it. What did he bring to the table? Money? Was that it, or what? Or what else? Or how was he enlisted to be a co-founder of the organization?
Well, Ted Turner has had an interest in particular in nuclear disarmament for a long time, and he has been focused on reducing all sorts of threats that really threaten, you know, life as we know it on the planet. So we know him as an environmentalist. Environmental crusader, really, for decades. And after Senator Nunn left the Senate, he and Ted Turner started talking about this issue of nuclear terrorism and whether this could be, you know, a threat that has the potential for as much profound impact as catastrophic environmental, you know, mismanagement. And so when we were looking at the beginning of NTI, at how to scope our organization, how to scope the mission of the organization, we focused on nuclear terrorism. But over the years, we also have begun to do a lot more work related to the reduction of nuclear weapons, in particular, and the potential of looking at a world without nuclear weapons.
Okay, so the original focus was to prevent terrorism and the nuclear weapons falling into the wrong hands, especially with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and all those weapons that were sitting around, hopefully not doing anything. I guess some of them came from the Ukraine, as a matter of fact. But now it's even more than that. You're concentrating not just on terrorists, but on states that might misuse them, such as you're probably very concerned about what's going on in Iran?
Well, sure. When we think about nuclear threats, there are really kind of three main categories. We talk about non-proliferation, disarmament, and nuclear terrorism. And while there are linkages and overlaps among them, the methods that one might think about reducing those threats are a little bit different. So non-proliferation, or the threat of proliferation, talks about nuclear weapons spreading to new countries. And that's really where we think about Iran and start considering what we need to do with regard to Iran. When we talk about disarmament, that's really related to the reduction or elimination of nuclear weapons from countries that already possess them, of which there are 9 in the world. And then when we talk about nuclear terrorism, there we're talking about non-state actors. So it's the thinking about the risks of an actual nuclear weapon, as you say, or more likely the nuclear material itself falling into the hands of a terrorist or a criminal and being on the black market somewhere where it could be acquired by somebody who intends to use it.
And NTI's one initiative is to create an international nuclear fuel bank at the International Atomic Energy Agency. And now this fuel is largely benign. I mean, it's not weapons grade that way. But I've been told by numerous sources that we're going to shortly start using weapons grade plutonium in our nuclear plants. Can you verify that?
Well, in the United States, there is no plan to use plutonium in our nuclear energy program, in our peaceful nuclear activities. There is one limited program within the United States that was designed to take plutonium out of nuclear weapons and then change it into a form where it could be used as fuel in nuclear power plants. That would be done at a facility that was being built in South Carolina. And as of now, that facility is on hold because it's been unfortunately the subject of a lot of price inflation, and the facilities cost billions and billions of dollars more than it was planned, and the whole life cycle of the facility is now expected to top $20 billion. And so the Secretary of Energy has just in early 2014 put that program on hold to reassess whether that's the best way to actually eliminate that weapon's plutonium. As far as civil plutonium, the United States doesn't actually remove the plutonium from our spent nuclear fuel and reuse it as fuel, but some countries do. Japan uses what's called mixed oxide fuel, or MOX fuel. That means it's a mix of plutonium and uranium. And France is a big separator of civil plutonium. And then there are a number of other countries that use the MOX fuel. They don't separate the plutonium themselves. They send it other places, and then they get it back to use as fuel. And that's, you know, Germany, Belgium, Italy, the UK, India, Russia. There are a number of countries.
So all this old plutonium that has been so dangerous is going to be used up. It just isn't currently being used in the United States, and may not be, at least until the Secretary of Energy decides to take this project in South Carolina off the hold button. Is that right?
Well, so we're really talking about material coming from two different streams. I think you made a really good point where you say nuclear fuel that's used in nuclear power plants is not by itself or kind of independently a risk for nuclear terrorism or to be used in a nuclear weapon. The reason we say that is because the fuel itself is usually low enriched uranium fuel, or in some very minimal cases, it's actually natural uranium. It's the form that it comes out of the ground. Low enriched uranium and highly enriched uranium, they're, you know, think about it on a spectrum. You know, you can have strong coffee, you can have weak coffee. It's how much of that, of those coffee grounds, how much of that coffee flavor is in the water. So what we're talking about with low enriched uranium is really weak coffee. There's not very much of this fissile U-235 isotope in it. Highly enriched uranium, which is anything above 20%, starts getting closer to being what we would call weapons grade or bomb grade, meaning it could be used in a nuclear weapon. To use something in a nuclear weapon, you really need to start getting up around 80% and ideally above 90% of this U-235, the fissile isotope. So the fuel that's going into nuclear power plants around the world generally is not available for nuclear weapons. The reason we worry about it, though, is because the same technology to enrich the uranium to 5% for a nuclear power plant, you can enrich to 90%. There's no difference in the industrial process. It's just how you choose to apply it. So we don't want this enrichment technology, you know, spreading around the world with very little constraint, because then you end up with a lot of countries which, while they may not currently be choosing to make weapons-grade uranium, they could, and there's no technical barrier. So then we talk about the other side, what happens to the fuel when it comes out of the plant. All nuclear fuel that is used in a nuclear power plant, when it's finished being used, contains plutonium. It's just a result of the reactions in the nuclear power plant.
Oh, really? Okay.
So then the question is, can that be used in a nuclear weapon? And the answer is, only if you separate it out of those fuel rods. The fuel rods are big, you know, assembled in fuel assemblies. If you would dispose of that in the ground or in, you know, above ground storage, it's really not a nuclear weapons danger. If you separate the plutonium, however, now you're creating material that becomes more vulnerable because it's more easily handled, it's smaller, and it can be directly used in a nuclear weapon as opposed to needing this additional processing. So the intersection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons or nuclear terrorism is really about the material. And there are certain points along the line where that material is more vulnerable and other points where it really can't be directly used.
Wow, what a clear picture you painted for us. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. That really clears up some questions. That explains why when Iran says that they deserve to have nuclear power plants and nuclear fuel, we worry a little bit because we know that it isn't going to be too much when they can go ahead and enrich it and make it weapons grade. And then that leads me to another question. If the nuclear waste contains plutonium, then you not only have to have security for the nuclear plants that are using these materials, but you have to have security for where the material is dumped, is stored?
You do. I mean, certainly it's important to have appropriate security over all nuclear material. The good thing, if I can put it that way, is that the fuel, when it comes out of the nuclear power reactors, it's highly radioactive. It's really dangerous to handle, and nobody who handles it could get very far without, you know, falling sick or immediately dying. So there's a phrase we use for this called self-protecting, meaning that anybody who tries to get, you know, to get at that fuel would die before they could do anything with it.
Okay.
So where we worry is where fuel is no longer self-protecting, and that happens over time. It also can happen if you start separating out the different elements of the fuel. If you remove the plutonium, for example, or you remove some of the high-activity material, then what's left is less self-protecting. And so fuel rods, as they come out of a reactor and for many, many years following, are not by themselves a nuclear weapons danger because you just can't get at that material directly unless you have a larger facility to handle it remotely. It still could be a potential for a nuclear or a radiological, radioactive terrorist event, for example, if one would try to explode a nuclear, use nuclear fuel location. You could disperse radioactivity that way, but it wouldn't be a mushroom cloud. It wouldn't be a nuclear weapon in the sense that we think of that.
Okay, so could be dangerous, especially if it was, I don't know if it has anything to do with what we hear about a dirty bomb or something like that, but it could be dangerous if it was just thrown out in the street someplace or put in a water supply or something of that nature. And then that leads to the other question that I get all the time about this nuclear waste that we have stored at different places around the country. And, what about the pollution dangers of that waste?
Well, certainly the environmental impact of nuclear technology as a whole has to be carefully managed, and that has to do with, everything from water supply to, air radiation leaks and other sorts of ways in which radiation could affect the environment or the human populations. I am not an expert on environmental impact of specific technology, but we do kind of separate into a few different concerns. I had mentioned, the difference between proliferation or the worry about states and terrorism, the worry of non-state actors. This is another area where there's, some terminology that helps us separate. We talk about safety versus security. And when we talk about safety versus security, they both have to do with preventing the harmful impacts of radiation on people or the environment. But safety is related to kind of the things that could happen through mechanical or natural processes. You think about a meltdown, a failure in the system, whereas security is something that happens through a deliberate act. And that's where we talk about sabotage, where a deliberate actor is trying to do something that would facilitate the release of radiation.
Yeah, I guess what you're referring to is what happened at Fukushima. It was not a terrorist attack, but and there isn't much that you, your organization, could do to prevent that. People have to, on their own, figure that they might get an earthquake or a tsunami or something of that nature, and they need to build the plants a little safer. What you're concerned with then is
lessons for that. But there were some security lessons as well, and in particular, one would hope that people with malicious intent didn't look at an event like Fukushima and say, oh, look at the impact this had. Let me figure out if I could actually create that impact. Maybe that, did we put a focus on the spent fuel ponds, for example? Did we put a focus on breach of the containment in a way that somebody who actually would try to intend to do that could try to do it? So it was a safety event, but it's very important that we use all information, including from a safety event, to draw some lessons on security and make sure we're preventing that from ever happening from a deliberate actor.
So that so Fukushima then is of interest to NTI and the things that you're doing. I've got a friend at Caltech, a nuclear scientist by the name of Ed Morse, and I asked him about the nuclear waste one time. He said the wonderful thing about nuclear waste, he said, it's a great problem to have because it's the only problem that goes away the longer you ignore it. And then of course he laughed, like you're doing. But the thing is that valuable?
Quite a long time.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I say you have to ignore it for quite a long time. We're talking, 10,000 years.
Yes, that's the joke. So anyway, he didn't give me much of an answer, and so I am concerned about what's going on with the nuclear waste. Somebody said we had to send it up in a rocket and shoot it into the sun. I said, yeah, right, the rocket fails, and then what kind of problems do we have? So what is the future then of this nuclear waste, since it could fall into the hands of the terrorists? Is it being guarded by military, or is it being guarded by private organizations, or who's guarding this stuff?
Well, generally, the civilian nuclear waste falls under the security purview of the company. So this would be private organizations that either have their own on-site guard forces and security personnel, or they may have contractors. And then the nuclear waste that is the result of our nuclear weapons program, our military programs, which, while they're not producing nuclear material anymore and haven't for a couple of decades, we still have some legacy material. Those are also generally protected by contractors because that's how our Department of Energy, our nuclear weapons lab infrastructure, manages their security. But I do think it's important to know that there are some answers on nuclear waste. We just haven't figured out how to implement them yet. What I mean by that is, the safest way to dispose of nuclear waste is to remove it from populations where it could affect people, to limit access to the material, put as much of a both physical and institutional barrier in between, meaning physical barriers, containers, earth, putting things in caves, for example, and then institutional barriers, meaning you don't want these things to be part of general commerce. You don't want this material to be moving around the country regularly. You don't want it to be part of a civil energy program where you're producing and removing and producing and removing the material on a regular basis. The problem is that, as you know and many of your listeners know, having the right technical answer is not the same thing as having the right political answer.
Yeah, right.
And so when it comes to nuclear waste, we've all been following the travails of the facility at Yucca Mountain. That is generally a technically sound answer, but it was not politically sound.
Yeah.
And so we need to work harder. We need to know that this is a multi-generational consequence we've created through our nuclear energy program. And while we can't ignore it forever, we do have a little bit of time to figure it out. What I mean by that is above-ground dry storage of nuclear fuel can be a very safe, very reliable, and secure way to manage this material, and that gives us about 100 years. So that gives us about 100 years to figure it out, according to the absolute experts. So we need to not just do this for 100 years, but we need to actually use that time to figure out what the longer-term strategy is. We can't just wait and then in the 99th year say, oh, no, now we need to start answering this question again.
Okay, but I think the problem with Yucca Mountain was maybe not the place where it was going to be stored, but wasn't it the transportation of this material through communities on its way to Yucca Mountain?
Well, there have been questions that have been raised on kind of all aspects, the transportation, the storage, the security, the environmental characterization of the sites. And the United States is not alone, by the way. When I list all of these concerns, these are the same concerns that are being addressed by nuclear energy producing countries around the world. Europe is working together in kind of a coalition to try to figure it out. In East Asia, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they're running up against the edges of their storage capability, and they're desperately trying to figure out what to do with this material. So this is a problem for kind of the adolescence of the atomic age, if you think about it that way. We now have 50 years of experience producing nuclear energy, and we haven't really had to deal with the problem yet, but now we do. We're running out of storage at the sites of the reactors, and we haven't created the long-term storage that one might have hoped, and meanwhile the politics on the other side have changed with regard to the use of the plutonium. So while some countries might have intended that they would have a smaller storage responsibility because they'd actually separate out the plutonium, use that again, and that would, make it, we call reduce the footprint of the nuclear waste. Now, because of the politics of nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, the use of that plutonium is less acceptable than maybe it was thought to be. So we really have a challenge globally to deal with this, and we need to start talking about it globally. We need to have some broader international discussions on how we can take advantage of the different elements that each of these different countries and nuclear users are bringing. Some may be able to dispose. Some may be able to use up the existing plutonium, of which there is, tons of it in the world. So we need to start working together, and this conversation has so far been disjointed.
Yeah, and then I believe, so to summarize what you're saying is to rid the world of this weapons-grade plutonium left over from the superpowers building these warheads in a peaceful manner, like using it for nuclear power fuel, is a daunting task, and there's no current solution or method for the doing of it. I want to talk more about this after the break at the half hour, so we'll be right back. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Sun Tzu, writing in The Art of War. Subjugating the enemy's army without fighting is the true pinnacle of excellence.